It's time for Money for Lunch, where we feed your brain and your business with supersized portions of business and financial news. Now your host, Bert Martinez.
All right. Good to have you guys here. It's the kind of the weekend edition of Money for Lunch. Good stuff happening. And I'm excited about our first guest simply because I think that the subject matter is so important. And I think a lot of people are confused by a lot of different, I'll just say that we as a society are typically confused by the money game, how to make money, keep it, how to, square away our finances and our retirement. My first guest, Sam McElroy, co-founder and managing member of Financial and Financial Investments. Sam has always made every effort to go a step beyond your typical financial advisory firm by utilizing client-focused discovery, planning, and implementation processes aimed at creating a tailored solution for both businesses and individuals. In addition to traditional planning concepts, Sam has focused on development of practical, natural consequences-based approach to customizing effective solutions on an individual basis. Sam McElroy, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Hey, thanks for having me, Bert.
All right, walk me through this. When you say natural consequences-based planning, what are we talking about?
Yeah, that's a great question. Here's the philosophy behind it. A lot of the times when people are trying to figure out a financial aspect, there's a lot of information out there. And the question becomes, how do you take that theoretical knowledge and turn it into a practical approach for your own individual situation? So for a lot of people, when they're looking at trying to make decisions and some of the things that are going through those processes, sometimes you have to make a course correction or you have to make a deviation from the standard textbook. And that's what we mean by making those practical applications.
Gotcha. All right. Now, let me ask you this. When a lot of people think of their finances, their retirement, they automatically, they think of a broker. That's typically, I think, the front end picture of, how we're going to pay for our finance, our retirement. What is it that you guys, how are you guys different? I mean, what is it that you guys do versus, let's say, a broker?
Yeah. So the biggest difference is that, a broker primarily is charged with trying to help you manage the accumulation of wealth or manage the development of a portfolio. Where we kind of differentiate ourselves is that in addition to handling that wealth management aspect, we do everything really from a financial planning, financial advisory standpoint. So we specialize in the integration of not only wealth management, but financial planning and risk management as well.
Gotcha. All right. Let's talk about this. Millennials retirements. Millennials right now, widely talk about in the financial industry that millennials are really not that concerned with retirement. They're really delaying that. Do you find that to be true?
Yeah, I do. And I wouldn't say that they're not concerned with it. I think it's more of just an issue of they're trying to figure out how to fit it into all the other demands they have for their cash flow. With a lot of millennials, especially if they're coming out of a college education where they may have racked up some student debts, we find that instead of just launching straight into a career path, that a lot of them have to take a few years to be able to set themselves up. If it's between them trying to shed some debt or maybe being able to get their feet under them with respect to a career path, it seems like a lot of the stuff that used to happen in our 20s is now happening more like in our 30s.
Yeah. And it's interesting, too. The other issue that we have is that we're all living longer, right? So where, you would typically retire around the age of 60 or 65, and, you only had to worry about living maybe, 10 or 15 years. Now, that's not the case. To find somebody who's lived to the age of 90 is very commonplace. Even 100 doesn't shock us anymore, but certainly 90 is very common, and we really have to make that money work harder, faster, and at the same time protect it more.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. You know, we joke about it a lot here, but if you think about it, for a lot of people, they may be retired almost as long as they were working. So if they're working for 35 to 40 years and they're retired for another 30 years or so, then you're absolutely right that, you know, all the things that, you know, could have been solved to some degree by the fact that money didn't have to last quite as long is now increasing a lot of the risks associated with retirement because they have to figure out how to make it work for a much longer extended period of time.
Yeah, no, absolutely. All right, speaking of money, we're going to take a quick commercial break. Sam, I got to pay some bills, and then we'll be back and we'll talk more about you and retirement right after this.
Did you bring the camera phone?
I did.
Do you want to go first?
I've been waiting for this all day.
Okay, this is Fro
and Stacy.
Introducing Chase Quick Deposit. Just photograph the front and back of your check using the Chase mobile app on your iPhone and hit send.
It went through?
So cool.
This is so cool.
You want to try it?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right, it was nice.
Make a deposit from anywhere, anytime with your iPhone.
To Mr. and Mrs. Walker, why would they send my parents a check?
Chase what matters.
All right, we are back. We're talking about you and your retirement, your money, with co-founder and managing member Sam McElroy. And so let's talk about this real quick. Let's talk about, you know, we were talking about millennials. We've talked a little bit about baby boomers. You know, back in the day, $1 million in retirement was kind of like the target, very common target. If you had $1 million in retirement, you were good to go. But like for the millennials, that's not a clear target anymore, or is it? Give me your thoughts.
Yeah, this is really an interesting topic because there's a couple converging factors that are kind of playing into this. You know, when you look at retirement income or how a portfolio might translate into retirement income, it's really a makeup of two variables. You know, you have your account balance on one hand and you have your withdrawal rate on the other hand, and those together will let you know how much you can withdraw on an ongoing basis. So this guy Bingen actually did the first safe withdrawal studies back in the mid-90s, and what they basically found is that, you know, if you wanted a portfolio to last 30 years or longer, you could use a 4% withdrawal rate and adjust for inflation from there, and if you wanted it to last 20 years or longer, you could use a 5% withdrawal rate. So now when we take into account all the things that we just talked about, the fact that people are living longer, the idea that people maybe are starting to save a little bit later in life, but couple in the fact that in this current low interest rate environment that we're in, when these safe withdrawal studies were replicated, they're finding that it's actually a lower percentage that you can pull out, maybe something closer to 3% as opposed to 4 or 5%. So what we see is that there's a convergence of kind of negative factors that's going to ultimately impact millennials later on. So I think it's, you know, it's hard to put a dollar amount to it, but I think if the old axiom was that people needed $1 million to try to retire, thinking that you're going to need $2 million isn't out of the question. But more important than any dollar amount, the point that I think we're really trying to emphasize with anybody looking for retirement that's going to be, you know, 20 to 30 years out from now, is that there is an increased need to save and to do the things that we can on our part to be able to make sure that we're going to have a successful retirement.
Yeah, and you know what, and it is really challenging because, you know, we saw back in 2008, 2009, where people who followed the rules, right? I mean, they had a bunch of money in retirement, they were doing what they were supposed to do, and all of a sudden they lost, like a lot of us, we lost a lot of money overnight.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And really what you're emphasizing there is this other kind of hidden risk factor that isn't talked about a whole lot, which is order of return risk. So, you know, right when you're about retirement age or getting closer to it, you know, the sequence of returns or the impact of having negative returns right around that retirement date actually can change the entire trajectory for a retirement plan. So kind of like you said earlier, it's not just about accumulating assets, but it's also being mindful of how to protect what you have accumulated.
Yeah, and I think that protection thing is again, it's the same side, different side of the same coin, and it's a little bit, harder to do because, you know, how do you protect your money to avoid what we saw in 2008, 2009. Is there any way of protecting yourself against that, or you just had to have the foresight to pull out of the market just in time?
Yeah, to some degree, but you know, some of the axioms that we all kind of play by as far as reducing some of our market exposure the closer we get to retirement, I mean, some of those things are good mechanisms to try to help reduce our risk. I think that as we get closer to retirement, being mindful of how we're invested, maybe getting away from some of the appreciation stuff, oriented more towards some income strategies is another way to kind of reduce some of our market risk. But there's also practical things that we can do up until retirement to try to help ourselves out. For example, being very mindful to try to not go into retirement with debt outstanding, I think is a great idea, because anything you can do to alleviate some of the pressure or the need to have your assets kind of working at full capacity, I think is going to be helpful. So being mindful of tax strategies, you know, being mindful of getting rid of debt so that you don't need quite as much cash in retirement, I think all those things coupled with just trying to be mindful of current economic environments and kind of your proximity to retirement, I think is all going to, you know, help to aid in the situation.
Sure, sure. All right, let me ask you this. Getting off the dime and investing it. What do you mean, getting off the dime and investing it?
Well, I think one of the things that we have to look at is making sure that, you know, as we're investing money, that we're allowing the compounding effect of time just to basically work in our favor. So a lot of the times, and I can think about a client in particular that we have now, they're concerned with their own economic environment. They're concerned with their ability to pay bills. And for some people, not all people, they tend to hold a little bit more in cash or in safe investments than maybe what they need to. So part of this whole process, I think, is being able to identify how much you actually need as liquid reserves and making sure that you are investing, you know, what you can invest to be able to allow that time value of money and compounding effect to be able to help you out.
Gotcha, gotcha. All right. I want to get your thought on this, so I kind of saved it for last. I know a lot of people are concerned about Social Security, whether it'll be around. And I kind of wanted to get your thoughts on this. Millennials are worried about Social Security. What's your take on Social Security as a retirement strategy? Should it be something that we count on or just look at as a bonus and not count on it at all? What do you think? What are you telling people?
Well, from what we found, Social Security tends to account for 30 to 40% of the income that people live off of in retirement. And when the plan was started, that may not have been the intention, but it is kind of the reality. Now, Social Security is really funded by two sources. There's the trust fund, and then there's also incoming revenue from people that are currently paying their taxes from earned income. We know that Social Security is projecting that by 2033, 2034, the trust fund is going to be depleted and we're going to be relying solely on basically incoming revenue. And they're projecting that that would be enough to cover 75% of benefits. So we don't know what the future of Social Security holds, but what we do think is that so many people are dependent on it that something's going to have to change to be able to create the program to make it more solvent. I know that a lot of the clients we work with actually do view it very much as the cherry on top, that they want to be okay with their own assets, and if they get Social Security, great. From a practical standpoint, we haven't seen a whole lot of plans, regardless of net worth, that have the same probability of success if you were to just pull Social Security out of it. So I think we need to, you know, be tentative about what's going to happen, but I don't think that we need to be so scared that it's just not going to be there in the future. It just may look a little different for millennials or people that are going to be retiring at a later date.
I love it. All right, good stuff there. Sam McElroy, I want to say thank you so much for stopping by. And you're the co-founder of Financial and Financial Investments. Is that the name of the company? I just want to make sure I have it clear. Yeah. I'm looking at my teleprompter, and it's just like the way it's written. I want to make sure I'm explaining it correctly.
Yeah, it's actually at Financial and at Financial Investments, but there's probably a little sign that's showing up.
Yeah, at Financial and at Financial Investments. Sam McElroy, we'll have you back again to talk more about our money.
Okay, sounds good. Thanks a lot, Bert.
You bet. Good stuff there from Sam McElroy at Financial and at Financial Investments. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and then we'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to Geico Radio. It's savings on the radio.
Cooler, Steve. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just got a free rate quote on geico.com. Saved a ton, and it only took me 5 minutes and 12 seconds. I was wondering, is that some sort of record?
That's a good question. Then let's have a look.
Not quite. Someone's got you beat by 8 seconds.
Still, I mean, that's quite fast.
Well, what if I told you I only use one hand?
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All right, we are back. If you are in the Arizona area, specifically, I guess all of Arizona, my next guest will be of keen interest to you. Nick Petra is president of Strategic Duck, a consummate businessman and visionary. He's a certified financial planner, business coach, mentor, educator, writer, and lifelong entrepreneur. Nick works with entrepreneurs on many levels of their business, from setting a solid foundation for business success through detailing and implementation of plans and objectives. He develops strategic plans customized for each business, and he is instrumental in coaching each client to a new level of efficiency, productivity, and success in achieving their business goals and objectives. Nick Petra, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thank you. Glad to be with you this morning.
All right. Now, you're here on behalf of the Arizona Small Business Association. So explain to me your role with the Arizona Small Business Association.
Yes. I am current chair of the board of directors. We're a 40-year-old organization that has as its mission statement to provide small business owners and operators, we want to provide them access to people and resources to develop and grow both personally and professionally. In other words, I think we really want to help small business owners achieve their dreams.
I love it. And you know what? And sometimes people forget this, but, small business owners, we really represent a huge part of the economy. We employ a lot of people. And sometimes we don't get the assistance that we need or that we should get. So I love the Arizona Small Business Association. I've been to a couple of the meetings. We've had some of the members here on the show. And you guys do a phenomenal job. I did not realize you guys were 40 years old. That's phenomenal.
I'd like to share a little bit more about your statistics that you mentioned about the small businesses. Very few people realize that, but the economic engine that drives the United States economy is the small business. Nationwide, there's about 28 million small businesses. So there's a lot of people in Arizona. Throughout the United States, small businesses employ about 500,000 of the nation's private workforce. And almost all the firms with employers are small. They make up about 99% of all employers nationally. So I think that sort of shows you the importance and the economic engine that small businesses can provide. In Arizona, we have over 500,000 small businesses. So it's really a very important segment of all the economy throughout the United States.
Yeah, it's amazing. And we look at some of these big companies like Walmart, like Apple, like you name it, Dow Chemical, and these all started as a small business.
Absolutely. Everybody has to start somewhere, and one of the things that we have to do is all of us have to recognize and support small businesses. This is an interesting statistic that I just remembered. In the last 6 years, small businesses created 5.5 million net jobs. In the same period of time, large businesses lost 1.8 million jobs. So you can see the importance of it. The big problem we have with small businesses is they're alone. You got a sole person, the solopreneur trying to start a business, and the failure rate is about 70% in the first 5 years. So they really need the help and the support that the Arizona Small Business Association can provide them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. So let's talk about the Arizona Small Business Association. Obviously, it's Arizona, not Phoenix. So you guys help anybody in the Arizona market. What kind of benefits as a member do I get from the Arizona Small Business Association?
Well, a couple of things. You know, a lot of people, when they start a small business, they have an idea for something or whatever the reason is for having to start a small business. They either lost a job or they've got a great idea. And so they're going to go out there and go straight ahead with the program. What we provide is we provide effective small business education, you know, which teaches people how to do business plans, marketing plans. We talk about social media. We talk about the HR. We talk about financial records. We provide a whole gamut of education that the small business owner can reach out and grab and use. On top of that, we try to provide professional dynamic professional connections where they can mingle and talk to other business owners and share their problems. We're very active in the public policy part of Arizona. We really pushed the crowdfunding issue through the legislation as an accomplishment of Arizona Small Business Association. So we provide a lot of essential services. In addition to that, we provide some buying power for the small businesses by belonging to a group. We can provide some great resources for small business owners.
Yeah, I love it. You know what? And this is so important because business is politics. Excuse me. And when you're a solopreneur, when you're a proprietor, when you're a small business owner, and maybe it's just you and a couple of employees, you don't think you have a voice. One of the things that I enjoy about the Arizona Small Business Association is that it really helps us all get a voice, especially in a noisy place like government, where if you're not big, you're ignored. And this way, you can team up with the Arizona Small Business Association and get your voice heard.
Yeah, it's very important that they get heard. And it's also very important that they have the resources to be able to grow their business. Because really the basic foundation of ASBA, the Arizona Small Business Association, is to ensure the survival, to give the people the tools they need to survive. You know, what do you do now that I want to start a business? One of the other features that we have at the Arizona Small Business Association, which is very unique, we have gathered about 25 of the very best consultants and mentors in the state of Arizona that volunteer their time to work with small businesses. And we work with small businesses. Each of these men and women commit to a six-month period of weekly meetings with small business owners. And they help them achieve their objectives. And where you have a failure rate in the small business of 70%, the people that have the mentoring and the coaching that is provided, we have about a 95% success ratio. So it really shows the importance of. And we have to show the importance of these people getting some support, and that's really our main objective.
No, I think that's fantastic. It makes such a huge difference to have somebody help you, let you step over some of those big landmines, and really just sometimes it's just these little nuances that can make a big impact. I had a friend of mine who used to say, how much does a train need to be off the track before it's off the track? I mean, it's just that little bit can make a huge difference.
Yeah, I think it's very important. You know, we have a model that we use over there, probably been used by other people, but we tell people it's good to be in business for yourself, but not by yourself.
Yes.
You know, and so we really commit to the success of the small business people, and we really encourage them to reach out and join. You know, we are not an expensive association to join. Our fees are only $235 a year. And the benefits and the support they get is phenomenal. And we have a very dynamic online presence. We do offer classes and seminars and mixers and a lot of functions that these people get involved in. And this year, more than ever, we're trying to get our membership involved in a lot of, you know, more active than just being a passive member, but having them contribute to the direction that Arizona Small Business Association is taking and the way what kind of support they need.
I like that. Okay, let's talk about this because you are often heard to say accountability is essential for growth in your business. So talk about that. Why is accountability so essential?
You know, I have a favorite definition of character. that I give, and it's as follows: ability to carry on after the mood has left you. And what happens with small business owners, they're really excited when they go out there and they get all these great plans, and then they get up in the morning and say, oh my gosh, have I really got to do all this to be successful? So holding people accountable is one of the biggest things that we hold through our mentor group, our business mentor group that's structured within the ASBA, Arizona Small Business Association. We bring and hold accountability to people. We take a small business owner, and he's got all these great ideas. We try to format it in some kind of an order or system for them, and then we hold them accountable on a weekly basis to do what they said they're going to do. And that really is, in my opinion, the strength that any small business has. If they could be held accountable to somebody, to a peer group, to a mentor, to a coach, whatever their goal is, whoever they find in their lives that can help them, then that accountability factor is what's going to help them become successful.
Yeah, I love that. Accountability, I know that most of us hate to be held accountable, but we know if you have children, if you have employees, that accountability makes us stronger, makes us better, makes us reach our goals faster. So it's such a powerful tool. Hey, real quick, Nick, I want to just mention, you have a company, I mentioned this in the intro, called Strategic Duck. Love the name. What is Strategic Duck all about?
Well, what we do is, I'm a small business advocate and have been for the last 25 years. And my goal is to help small businesses support. You know, what we do, we try to work with small business owners, and we specialize in companies under 200 people down to startups and on up. And we go in and we work with them, and whatever area they need, we help them identify what their needs are. We try to look for solutions to their problems or whatever area that they are. You know, as small businesses, the economic engine that drives the United States, and we have a 70% failure rate. How much better would we be as in the United States economically if we can keep another 5% of those people from failing?
Yes.
Stop and think of the economic impact that could have. And the Strategic Duck, that's what we reach out to do. We do that as our business. We reach out to people in all walks of life, and we work with people in person. We work with some on Skype, depending where they're located. But the whole objective is to have a system and hold them accountable and help them find direction in what they do. And that's what Strategic Duck is all about.
I love it. I love it. And you know what? What's so great about what you've done is you've really taken this passion and you've run with it. Not only is that what you do for your business with the Strategic Duck, but as you said, you're an advocate, and with the ASBA, the Arizona Small Business Association, you're able to help and reach more businesses. So this is obviously a passion of yours that you've had for a long time, and it's great because, as we've already talked about, so many small businesses struggle. 95% of them or 90% of them go out of business within the first 2 years or whatever the number is. It's a high number because it is a tough thing to do, especially when you're trying to do it by yourself. And what the Arizona Small Business Association does is that even though you're by yourself, as you mentioned, you're not on, what is it? You're by yourself.
Yeah, well, you're in business for yourself, but you're not by yourself. And I think that's the message we need to get out to these people is that there is help out there for them, and they don't have to be alone. And that's what the Arizona Small Business Association is. If they just want to reach out and just learn about the support we offer and really help their businesses.
Nick, we're going to end on that note. Love to bring you back and talk more about the Arizona Small Business Association. You guys do such a great job here in the Phoenix market. Nick, Petra, thank you so much for stopping by today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to be with you.
All righty. Good stuff there about the Arizona Small Business Association. Why did I have them on the show? Because these guys do exceptionally good work. So they help small business operators. Yes, they're in my hometown, but they do work. They do exceptional work, and I just wanted to give them a shout-out because – there's not enough good business organizations out there. Anyway, we're going to take a quick commercial break. We'll be back right after this.
Well, I'm not sure what it is. I guess I'll be okay.
I'm calling the studio, Matthew.
You're not shooting today.
Just get some rest.
He bought it.
Hi, can I get my CRV brought up, please?
Roderick.
Oh, yeah.
Roderick.
Life is packed with things you have to do.
But sometimes you gotta live a little.
Matthew, you poor thing. You sound awful.
How could I resist?
Look, I don't know what to tell you. He's sick. Actors get sick sometimes.
Thanks.
Have a good night.
Life moves pretty fast. If you don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it.
Get going in the all-new CR-V from Honda.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.
All right, we are back. Excuse me. My next guest, Galila Subhatu. I hope I got that close. Galila Subhatu is an entrepreneur, business consultant, motivational speaker, and owner of GPS Professional Coaching, which provides individuals career advice on career transition, resume review, and interview preparation. Galila draws on her managerial hiring and career counseling experience at Fortune 500 companies to uncover the keys to career success. Galila Subhatu, welcome to Money for Lunch.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
All right. Did I get your name close?
Yes. Actually, you did it perfectly well.
Well, good. All right, let's talk about this. I mean, you know, here you are. You're a contributing author for Intern Match. You've been mentioned in Washington Magazine. You've also appeared as an executive master of business administration. You also have an executive master's business administration for Virginia Polytechnic Institute and State University. I wanted to ask you this. What are the most typical reasons people quit their job?
Usually it's about the money. Most of the time people are looking for more money, and they realize that if they stay at one job, as far as staying there every year, salary increases are about 1-3%. Particularly with this economy, it's not moving much. So they say, you know what, looking around, I can make more money switching, having a gain of 20 to sometimes even 30% if it's a good economy. So that's usually one of the main drivers that people look for other jobs. Another popular one is just lack of passion. They're not interested in their work that they're doing on a daily basis, and they may not have a good relationship with their boss. So those are the most typical reasons, but it may not be the best reasons.
Gotcha. You know, you mentioned their boss, and I think that, you know, you're right. I think it is money and the boss, because people aren't quitting the company. They're either quitting the money or they're quitting their boss.
Right.
Yeah, so I think you hit the nail right on the head. All right, so let's talk about this. In your opinion, what are some of the signs that it might be time to quit your job?
Yeah, I think you really need to do some soul searching and first look internally and figure out, what are your career goals? Is your job currently that you're doing right now, is it going to help you get to where you want to be in the next 2, 3, 5 years? So really kind of assessing where you are, and is that going to help you move forward? And also, do you really have the Monday blues every Monday? Are you just dreading going to work on Sunday? And if it's not just once in a while, if it's kind of constantly always there, you're kind of just dreading it. And maybe the stress of work is kind of having a physical or mental effect on you, and you're like, you know what? Just internally, you're just not feeling that great. And then kind of slowly looking outward. Okay, how's your relationship with your boss? How's your relationship with your work environment, with your teammates? And then the company itself. You know, that's also a really great way of kind of saying, is it time to stay? Is it time to leave? How is the company culture? Is it aligned to what is important to you on the job? Are they financially, you know, are they a profitable company? Are they doing well? Are there signs that they might have some issues? And also looking at their performance externally as well. So just looking at all these different things and figuring out, is it time, looking within and then kind of going outside and figuring out if there's other red flags that you should be aware of.
Yeah, no, I think that whole Monday blue thing is, a great indicator. I mean, if you just, you know, if it's like Sunday at 5 o'clock and you're already dreading it, it might be
right.
A good indicator that something's bad, right?
Yeah, especially if it's happening you know, every Sunday. You know, once in a while,
right.
It's fine. You know, you have some tough times. But if you're just really on a weekly basis, just ready going into work, you know, that's not a good way to start off your week.
All right, let me ask you this. So you have a tough – let's say you have a tough boss. And maybe – yeah, you guys aren't best of friends. What's your take? Is that a good enough reason to leave on its own?
You know, I think you have to really ask more questions as far as why don't you like your boss or why is your relationship with your boss not that great? If it's because they have a difficult personality, they're really grumpy or they're upset or controlling, that could be one. Or if they are condescending and, you know, are demeaning, that's another. So first you have to figure out what are those different reasons. What is it that is triggering you not to have maybe the best relationship? Because I don't really think you need to be best buds or have this friendship, but there needs to be a level of respect and appreciation for each other. So I think first figuring out why there are some issues there, and then kind of look at yourself and say, okay, am I communicating my needs? Am I communicating what I need on the job? Have I spoken with my manager about some of my issues? And, of course, being diplomatic and being conscious of that, but really kind of taking some ownership. You know, sometimes you have to manage upward. You have to manage your manager, right? And you also have to learn to deal with difficult people. So in life, whether it's your personal life or your career, whether it's this boss or another boss, people are difficult, and learning how to deal with difficult people is part of growing in a variety of ways. So I think not liking them is one, but I think that could be a learning opportunity on how to work with people who are different. But if they are, you know, there's no way out and you've kind of done everything you could do, being proactive and kind of communicating, and you feel as if they're just holding you back and they're not giving you maybe career upward mobility or not giving you the type of jobs and kind of respect that you deserve, then yes, I think that's a legitimate reason to kind of look elsewhere and kind of prepare your resume for like the next step in your career.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you know what? It's interesting because you hit so many good points on there. You really have to, like you said, ask more questions. What's really going on? And, you know, if your boss scares you, there's a good sign. If the boss is a demeaning individual, kind of a bully type of situation, there may be, you know, some other indications that it might be time for a change. But I like what you said. It's really about asking more questions and really finding out what's going on. The fact that you might have a strict boss may not be, you know, that's not a bad thing. You know, sometimes having a boss is kind of what's I'm looking for.
Firm. Trick.
Yeah, at least right. You know what to expect. If he's treating everybody the same, you can know what to expect. I'd much rather have somebody who has the same rules for everybody every day versus somebody who's nice one day and then kind of nasty the next day, and then you never know who you know which boss is coming in, right? It's just
that increases your levels of stress, right? That's increasing.
Yes.
Okay, how are they going to act? How am I going to, you know? And that kind of can be distracting when you're trying to just do your job and do a great, you know, type of work. So yeah, that can kind of increase your anxiety for the day.
Absolutely. Let me ask you this, and I know things have changed because when I was growing up, it was very typical to have somebody stay at a job for 20 or 30 years. What about today? How long do people typically stay at a job?
Yeah, you know, that has changed tremendously, especially starting in the late 90s with the dot-com and the boom. You know, like you said, before people would stay for years, 10, 12 years, that was actually an admirable thing to do. Wow, showing your loyalty, right? So that was how it was. But as you kind of slowly go from the 90s to now, working with a lot of the millennials, surprisingly, I saw a survey recently that they thought staying just a year was good enough. Like, okay, next, let's move on. And I don't really think that's correct and accurate. I think ideally you should shoot for 3 to 4 years is the average. And I think it really just depends on where you are in your career. So if you're starting out in your career, you're still exploring what you want to do, where you want to live, then you can have a little more latitude having a shorter career cycle at a particular job. So first job out of college, okay, at least be there at least a year. But as you slowly kind of grow into your experience, because, again, that first year is a honeymoon period. So you 6 months, it's like, yo, it's all roses. 6 months to a year, that's when the employee's building their character, you know, building their work ethics, kind of learning, you know, what they like and don't like on the job. After the year mark, then they can really see some of the opportunities flourish. They can kind of settle into their role and hopefully grow into it. And then by the second year, employees are really hopefully growing and lavish, you know, growing into whether it's personal development, leadership development, they're given the opportunities to kind of expand. So the third and fourth year, they really should kind of look and say, okay, is there room for me to move up? Is there room for me to learn additional skills? And then if there's not, if you kind of have been stagnant and it's pretty much been the same and you don't see anything, you know, as far as any opportunities, then that's a good time and acceptable time frame. So if someone's looking at your resume and they're seeing, you know, 3 to 4 years, 5 years, 6 years, fine, but having some variety in that, then that's pretty good. But if you're having people switching every 6 months, a year, they're going to say, wait a minute, this guy looks like a job hopper, and they're just trying to get more money. And, you know, we need them to at least stick around, because a lot of these companies, they don't just give you salary. They give you They give you training opportunities. So they're pouring money into you in addition to your salary. So they don't want to invest in people who aren't going to be invested with the company. So, yeah, I would say about 3 to 4 years is the average as of right now.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought that up. Staying with the company for a year, yeah, I would say maybe, you know, I think that one of the things that you brought up that a lot of employees don't understand is that somebody hires you, there's a cost involved with training you and getting you ready. And so, you know, but at the same time, you might, you know, as you said, you take your first job straight out of college. You're not really sure what you want. You're not really sure what's going on. So maybe your first job only lasts a year or 18 months. Why? Because you're starting to figure it out. And so sometimes it does take that. And then maybe you might switch, like you mentioned, 2 or 3 or 4 jobs in a lifetime career. But you might stay in that same career area because it's what you're passionate about. And people can look at that and say, oh, look, you know, Bert's been at the same career for 20 years. Yeah, he's had 4 or 5 jobs. And so maybe they have to find out what they need to do to retain people. It's interesting to me nowadays, it's very commonplace where the employer, especially around Silicon Valley, since you brought up the bubble tech thing, daycare, lunch, meals, not just lunch, but in some cases, you know, I know a lot of startups, not even startups, I know a lot of companies that have like a, they call it a cereal bar, where not only can you go there and have breakfast, but you know, they also give you goodies for lunch as well. There's on-site daycare. Employers have really stepped it up to retain good talent.
Exactly. I mean, just like a perfect example, Google and all these other companies, they have game rooms. It's a very more fun environment where, you know, you're kind of expressing your creativity through having fun, and that's how work should be. You should be enjoying yourself on the job. And I think something that a lot of business owners and leadership and entrepreneurs, when they're having their company, because money is, of course, the first thing that people think about when switching, but if you're able to give them something that money can't buy, right? When you can give them something that they enjoy, their colleagues, they enjoy the work they do, they enjoy just going to work, that's something that you can't find everywhere. So I think that's really behooves companies to really think about what they're offering their employees to retain them, as you mentioned.
I love it. Galila, we're out of time. Good stuff there. Galila Subhatu.
You're close.
All right, Galila, thank you so much for stopping by. It's been a pleasure. Looking forward to speaking with you again.
Oh, same here. Thanks a lot.
You bet. Good stuff there from Galila Subhatu about, you know, how different it is today than it was when I was growing up, when I was going through my, I would call it, working through the ranks, so to speak. A lot of good stuff covered today. Hope you guys have a great weekend. Remember, you work great.
Tune in Monday through Friday here on Money for Lunch. And check out our website at moneyforlunch.com.